The most trusted and longest-running sports talk show in Tennessee. From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting, this is Sports Talk with John Wilkerson and Jimmy Hines on Sports Radio WNML.
Number three as Sports Talk begins with Jimmy Hyams. I'm John Wilkerson. Once again, we head to the Stanley Fence and Gates hotline. It's always a pleasure to say hello to our good friend John McClain in the Houston Chronicle. You can follow his work at TexasSportsNation.com. A fantastic follow on Twitter at McClain_on_NFL. John, how are you?
I'm doing great, guys. How are you?
Doing well, thank you. And I hope everybody so far is safe and sound in your neck of the woods.
They are, and I feel hope the same thing for you guys.
Yes, sir. So as we get closer and closer to the virtual draft, it seems as though there is a very specific concern, one, of people letting IT people into their house to get all the equipment installed, and then also the IT people don't seem to be so fired up about going into a bunch of different homes to make sure they're ready. What do you think of all this?
I don't blame them, because you can be asymptomatic and not show any signs of having the coronavirus, but you can have it. And all the experts say that. So are they going to get special testing with quick results, which is not fair at all, because there's people that have it that are showing signs of symptoms that can't get tested. That would look terrible for the NFL. It would look terrible for politicians. Like here in Houston, like so many other states, not all of them, but most of them, they have, if you're not an essential business, you got to be closed. Well, the NFL is not an essential business, so they can't go to their facilities or their stadiums. That's why they got to do it like this. But I don't, you know, are they going to equip the IT guys in hazmat suits that could be used at hospitals? They're going to have to be really careful fighting that battle in the court of public opinion, because it looks like the NFL would be getting special treatment, and you cannot have that go on at such a critical time in our nation's history. But I don't blame teams not wanting, like a head coach or GM, people coming in their house, and I don't blame the people having to go in there and fortify their internet. I don't blame them for being worried either.
John, do you think we should have the draft in late April?
I have thought all along, yes, they should have it, because there's no reason not to, except what we're talking about right now. People are worried about, some coaches and GMs are worried about being on Zoom and having Zoom get hacked. Well, they've been using Zoom to interview players, to meet with each other. They've been using FaceTime. They've been using Skype. Can a good hacker get into all that? But, of course, a lot of them are paranoid. I know the Steelers would like to have another three rounds to draft. That's not happening. And I think we're going to look back on this, and the teams that usually do a good job will do the best job, and the teams that don't will be the ones that don't do a good job, because that's just their nature. And I'll say this, the ones that did the best job in the fall and the one of going to games and watching tape and talking to coaches, trainers, strength and rehab people, it's like doing an investigative story. NFL general managers, scouts, personnel people, they got to call on their sources to give them good information about prospects. Like if you call John and you say, so tell me this, what's Jimmy's strength and Jimmy's weaknesses? And if John trusts you, he'll tell you. If he doesn't trust you, he's not going to tell you the truth, and you got to be careful.
Do you think there's any merit to having three extra rounds?
I don't think so, because right now those I wouldn't, and I say this every year, Jimmy. You don't want to be a seventh round pick. You would rather not be taken in the seventh round and have multiple teams interested in you as an undrafted free agent. Then you got a chance to get a little more money. Remember when Arian Foster came out of Tennessee, the several teams, including the Texans, Saints and Jets wanted him, and the Texans gave him a little more signing bonus and a multi-year deal, and it turned out to be one of the best moves in franchise history. And so that's why the people that do the best jobs, they start talking to those potential free agents after the first day of the draft, after the second day, and as they get down to the third day, they're calling them saying, you know, hey, if Jimmy doesn't get drafted, we're going to take him, and telling the agent. And so those agents that have multiple choices, they're a whole lot better off than the guys that get drafted in those late rounds.
John, do you think that teams should get a little bit extra time for their draft pick?
Now, I do like that one. I think that they used to have more time. I think they should get 15 minutes instead of 10. There's contingencies for everything. You know, if Jerry Jones, if his, wherever Jerry is in his kitchen, you know, you don't have to be at your house. You can be at a site, somebody else's house, if that's where you've been working. And one thing we're not clear on, the league hasn't told them, how many people can they be with them if they practice social distancing? Can you have your head coach and general manager, your head of personnel, while all your scouts are on Zoom with one of you, and the prospects that you're interested in that you want to talk to, they're on another Zoom? And so I like the idea of giving them more time. Considering the way the draft is spread out over 3 days, why not? The NFL Network and ESPN do a great job of analyzing the draft and doing features. One of the things I'm fired up about watching it on TV at home is I'll get to see those. When I'm at the Texans, and I like this part and I'll miss this part, but one of the best things about draft days is getting to BS with all your friends in the media and the PR people with the teams, and because you don't get that chance in off season except for the draft. So I'll miss that. And when I'm doing that, I don't get to pay attention to the feature stories and information. So I'm really pumped about that opportunity. And also fascinated about how they're going to pull this off. I think the viewership will be a record viewership. And I think it will be fascinating. And I think when it's over, we're going to look back and say, wow, ESPN, NFL Network, they did a really good job, because they always do.
You are 10 mock drafts into the season. Can you see a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah, the only one I care about is the last one, which will be Tuesday before the draft. If I went back over everything, I might actually get a few of them right. I don't do that because I'm worried that I didn't. The most I ever got in a mock draft, and that was the only one that it counts, is the last one. One year when I was covering the Oilers, I got 12. Usually it's in single digits. And, you know, a couple of picks up high that screws everything up and your whole draft goes down the toilet. So I have fun doing it. They get a lot of hits on our website, Texas Sports Nation. So I like doing it for that. And I do try to change them up. I've had my top three picks the same because I've changed a couple, but Joe Burrow and Chase Young, first two picks, they're locked. The key is, can Detroit at number three convince Miami and the Chargers that one of the others trying to trade up to get, say, Tua Tagovailoa, and get one of them to make a trade? And either way, they should still be able to get a great player like cornerback Jeff Okuda or outside linebacker Isaiah Simmons. So I think the trading will start there. And I can't remember if I told you guys this last week, and I'm sorry if I'm repeating myself. Something to keep in mind about this draft: there's not going to be an off-season program. Players are not going to get to work with coaches on the field. But for rookies, that is the most important thing about their orientation into professional football, are the OTAs, organized team activities, the rookie minicamp, the veteran minicamp, and they're not going to get that. They might get half of a training camp. They might get two preseason games. There's contingencies for no training camp, for the season being delayed, for the season not being played. Nobody wants to hear that. So will teams with a lot of picks start to trade them for next year's picks, or will they look to trade them for veterans? Because missing all this time of on-field instructions is not going to hurt veterans while it will rookies. Miami has 14 picks. I'm guessing when the draft's over, they will not have drafted 14 players. So I'm guessing they will package picks to move up. They might package picks for next year where they already got two ones and two twos, count the Laramie Tunsil trade with the Texans. So that's something that I am really eager to see how teams operate, knowing that their rookies are going to get off to slow starts.
You've got six teams that don't have a first-round draft pick in Buffalo, Chicago, the Texans, the Colts, Rams, and Steelers. Who do you think would be the most likely, or do you think there would be more than one you would put in that group that would want to trade back in, perhaps into the second half of the first round?
I think it would depend on how high you're picking. The Texans, for instance, have the eighth pick in the second round. That came in Arizona trade for DeAndre Hopkins. They also have their second-round pick, 57th overall. It's a really deep draft for receivers. Say there was a receiver that they just have to have. Now, there's three in a class by themselves, Jerry Jeudy, CeeDee Lamb, and Henry Ruggs. And so most of us are picking them to be gone in about 10, 11, and 12, somewhere in the 10 to 15 range. Well, what if one of them just happened to slip and it was down to about 20? Would a guy like Bill O'Brien say, I'll give you two twos and a three, or two twos and a four, or two twos and a four next year, and you can still get the player you want, or you've already had a number one pick? You know, would they trade back with Miami? Miami has the 26th pick in the first round that did belong to Texas. Might they trade back for that if somebody like Love slipped? Or say they love Justin Jefferson from LSU, and he dropped. Most people have him going to Philadelphia. But what if he dropped? So, yeah, I could see guys doing that, especially at a time like this when you might not want as many draft choices.
Our guest, John McClain of the Houston Chronicle. He joins us on the Stanley Fence and Gates Hotline. We'll get a break. More with John coming up as you listen to Sports Talk on 99.1 The Sports Animal.
A sports car, we'd be red, fast, and expensive. 99.1 The Sports Animal.
Our guest, John McClain of the Houston Chronicle, as you listen to Sports Talk, he joins us on the Stanley Fence and Gates Hotline. I'm John Wilkerson with Jimmy Hyams.
John, Tom Brady on Howard Stern said that when asked about could he have done what he did without Belichick, he said, I don't believe I would have been able to do that, but I feel vice versa as well. He said, I can't do his job. He can't do mine. He said he also probably knew before the start of last season that he was going to leave New England. And he also said that it was time. I accomplished everything that I could. Did he say anything that surprised you?
Nothing at all. I mean, he's exactly right. They both brought out the best in each other. Greatest coach in history, greatest quarterback in history, and I don't think either one of them would have been without the other. One of the things that I think he wanted out of there is Bill Belichick didn't go out of his way to give Brady a lot of talent. He didn't see every number one pick be used in the first round. When Peyton Manning was in Indy, and Bill Polian was the general manager, he gave him skill position players in the first round almost every year. And it was like Belichick told Brady, you know, go ahead and make chicken salad out of chicken, you know what, and he was able to do that. I was watching a replay last night on NFL Network of that great Super Bowl in 17 here, in which the Falcons and Kyle Shanahan, the offensive coordinator, blew that 28-point lead, whatever it was, and how great Brady was. And every time you look up, he's throwing to Danny Amendola, Julian Edelman, Chris Hogan, Martellus Bryant. The Gronk was out injured. So it's amazing what Brady accomplished without having players that you would say, man, that guy's a great receiver. And so I would imagine one of the reasons he wanted to go to Tampa, he is playing with a coach, Bruce Arians, who is the opposite of Belichick. Now, Bruce Arians never won big like Belichick, and I think Belichick's personality, he rides those guys. They said he used to ride Brady like crazy because other players would go, whoa, if he's riding the number one player like that, I better toe the line, and so there was method to his madness. But now he goes with Bruce Arians, a player's coach. He's going to make it more fun. He's got two great receivers in Mike Evans and Chris Godwin, two good enough tight ends in Cameron Brate and O.J. Howard, and it might be a lot of fun, but they also might not even win their division because New Orleans is still the best team.
How far can Brady take Tampa Bay in those new uniforms?
A lot of people want to go back to those originals. I thought those originals were putrid because it reminded you of one of the worst teams in the history of pro football. But I looked at those uniforms, Jimmy, and I'm thinking, well, now where are the changes? There must have been subtle changes because it didn't look a whole lot different to me. And I think that they'll like those uniforms a whole lot better since Tom Brady's going to be wearing number 12.
What did you think of the new looks for the Rams, as there's been so much talk about just the logo, as well as with what we've seen now, I guess, with the Falcons, who they missed another opportunity to go back to the red, which I think they need to do. What do you think?
I agree with you. The Rams, I thought the Rams and the Chargers' original uniforms were so distinctive and good. I don't know why they didn't go back to the future. Go wear those same things. Nobody disliked those uniforms. It's instant recognition when you see the Ram and then you see the lightning bolt. And the reason they change them, of course, it's all about money. The money doesn't go to the team, it goes to the league, and then they get a distribution, and that distribution is big because one reason they play in Mexico and Europe is all about the sales of their gear. And you see more and more people wearing it. I was amazed when I was in London this past season. I'd see fans wearing Earl Campbell jerseys with the Oilers. You'd see them with Bart Starr jerseys with the Packers. So then they weren't old and used. It looked like that they had ordered them. And it was 80,000 people, and probably half of them were wearing jerseys. And so that's why they do it. And when you change uniform, people all want to rush out and buy all the new stuff. That's the way it's supposed to be.
John, you wrote within the last week about the passing of former Oilers coach Eddie Biles. You said that he made covering football a lot of fun. How did he go about doing that?
Well, that was not me saying that covering, because when he was head coach, he was terrible, and it was not fun. But when he was the defensive coordinator playing for Bob Phillips, it was a lot of fun because they had great defenses. When he was the defensive coordinator, he had Hall of Fame end Elvin Bethea, nose tackle Curly Culp, outside linebacker Robert Brazil, and it was their misfortune during what we call the Love You Blue era of Bum Phillips and Earl Campbell to be the second-best team in the NFL. Unfortunately for them, the Steelers and the Steel Curtain defense, they played in the same division, and they lost AFC championship games at Pittsburgh after the 78 and 79 seasons. And one of the best stories that a lot of people don't know about, in 1979, the Oilers played in a divisional round at San Diego. Don Coryell, had Dan Fouts at quarterback, Kellen Winslow at tight end. He had Wes Chandler. He had Charlie Joyner. Winslow and Joyner and Fouts are in the Hall of Fame. They were favored by 20 because the Oilers did not have quarterback Dan Passerini, running back Earl Campbell, or their leading receiver Kenny Burrow. They had a backup quarterback, Gifford Nielsen, who was a better sportscaster after his career was over than he was as a quarterback. So they also had a backup running back who was so hurt they had to shoot him up. He didn't know what state he was in. And they were 20-point underdogs, and they won. And one reason they won is they figured out that Dan Fouts, when he was under center, if he was going to run the ball, he would put his right foot a couple of inches to the right, his toes. His heel wouldn't move. And the middle inside linebacker, Greg Bingham, would see that, and he would yell, Army, letting his teammates know they were going to run. And if Fouts kept his foot straight, it meant he was going to drop back, and he would yell out, Air Force. And their strong safety, Vernon Perry, intercepted four passes, which is still an NFL record. And they pulled off one of the biggest upsets in history, and that is still the biggest football victory in our city's history, and will be unless the Texans finally win the AFC championship game to go to the Super Bowl.
John, we talked with Kim Mulkey at the start of last hour. She's a part of this big and really decorated class that's going into the Basketball Hall of Fame. It also includes Rudy Tomjanovich. What are your thoughts on Rudy T getting the call from the Hall?
Well, it is a great class, not just because of them. And one of the coolest videos I've ever seen, I watched it when Kim Mulkey went back to her house in suburban Waco, and she lives in a mansion on a street with mansions, and somebody in the back seat, probably her daughter, was filming this. As they got to the house, neighbors were all in the yard clapping for her, and they put up all kind of congratulations in her yard and their yard. And, of course, she was moved to tears. And then they shot one later when Kim was in the yard facing the street with her family. Fans just drove up and down the street, waves and waves of cars, wearing Baylor stuff, honking, waving at her, congratulating her. And she deserves it. She deserved it as a player. Her record as a player and as assistant coach and head coach is phenomenal. And I'm glad she's going in. Rudy Tomjanovich, great player at Michigan, really good player of the Rockets, been a scout, assistant coach, head coach, won two championships. It's about time. The nincompoops that kept him out for so long should be ashamed.
Besides Mach 11.0, what are you working on?
Well, I don't worry about that until Monday, and I just saw from the boss at some point we got to do a 7-round mock on just the Texans pick. Thank God we don't have to pick every team. I'm writing a column for tomorrow on David Johnson, running back from Arizona, including the Hopkins trade, how he's expected to fit in. And we have a lot of stuff on Texas Sports Nation, and we're still coming up with ideas, and we have a special coronavirus section every day that's doing gangbusters. I'm really proud of the Chronicle. No layoffs, no furloughs. Actually, we got bonuses on this check, 22,000 Hearst employees. And so things are going really well for us. And thank you guys for letting me come on. Stay safe and make sure you keep your distance from people.
You as well, John. Thank you. That's John McClain of the Houston Chronicle. Thank you. That's joining us on the Stanley Fence and Gates Hotline. We turn our attention to Major League Baseball is up next. Video coordinator for the Cleveland Indians, Mike Barnett, joins us on 99.1 The Sports Animal. Sports Talk continues with Jimmy Himes. I'm John Wilkerson. Time once again to say hello to our good friend Mike Barnett, video coordinator for the Cleveland Indians, as he joins us on the Stanley Fence and Gates Hotline. Mike, how you holding up?
Well, I'm doing good, John. Jimmy, good to talk to you guys. It's, you know, it just kind of every day kind of runs into the next and not a whole lot to do. Really get up and try to go walk at Lakeshore and come back and watch TV and read a little bit. And like I said, we've had a couple Zoom calls to kind of try to keep us up to date as to what's going on. But other than that, there's not a whole lot to do right now.
Yeah, certainly understand. And you, of course, shared with us what it was like when the curtain fell on the baseball season to this point when everything was shut down. Tell me, with the reports being out or possible scenarios for a return to the field, what do you think and what's been your reaction to the notion about sequestering the major league teams in Arizona and just kind of playing inside a bubble until the all clear is sounded to return to respective homes?
Well, I think that there's a lot of excitement, optimism, and then there's a lot of apprehension. Nobody knows actually which direction this thing is going to go. I think players, the biggest thing that they have, especially ones with families, I know they all want to get back to playing baseball, but, you know, it could be where we could be out there for the entire season, 4.5 months or so. And I think the biggest thing is they're worried about leaving their families. But as far as the logistics of it all, could it work? Definitely. I mean, you have the facilities out there. They're all good facilities, so you're not worried about player health as far as playing on a, you know, ungroomed field that would be suitable for Major League Baseball. We do it all spring. You've got, you know, plenty of hotels out there. You've got Chase Field that you could use, and it would just be a strange thing going to the ballpark and playing a game and nobody in the stands, and you have to practice social distancing, I guess. And the thing that would be kind of weird that I've read about, but people, you know, players being in the stands and being 6 feet apart and you wouldn't use the dugout, that would be just a very strange phenomenon, and I think it would take, you know, a lot of getting used to. But as far as the facilities, and, you know, you look at Phoenix and really the whole state of Arizona, I think they've only had 2,800 confirmed cases. And it looks like every day we're getting more and more good news. But I could definitely see this happening, but they've got a lot of things to work out. But even with meals and things of that nature, we've got our own cooks that are with us all the time. So you would have meals available and everything like that. And Jimmy, you've been out there and seen the facilities. You've got,
yes.
It's amazing, you know, what you have out there, that would be available to teams day in and day out. But I, you know, the big questions too are, you know, what about testing? Are you going to have to test players daily? Should we use all these tests for that? I don't know. So there's a lot of questions that have to be answered, but is it a viable, possible scenario? It is. We'll just have to see how it plays out.
Mike, Mark Teixeira said that the plan is, quote, unrealistic. I don't want to argue that point, but one thing he said was that you don't have weights and you don't have batting cages for the players to use. I'm not sure if I would agree with that. As you mentioned, I've been out there and I've seen the facilities. I don't think that's the problem, the lack of a batting cage, lack of weights. Do you?
No, not at all. I mean, the facilities out there, and I'll tell you what, it's a little bit different, you know, and I'm sure he probably trained most of his career in Florida, but the facilities out in Arizona are top-notch, tremendously manicured fields. You've got a complex at every, you know, every team has a complex, basically, and the weight rooms are unbelievable. They're bigger than any health club I've been in. The cages, you've usually got anywhere from 6 to 10 to 12 batting cages that are undercover. So I don't see where that would be a problem. But I read the Teixeira article as well, and I think, like, the biggest point that he brought up is, are players going to buy in to going out there to being gone from their families for 4.5 months and be sequestered?
I also don't know the answer to this, but there has been some talk among medical officials that know a whole lot more than I do, that maybe with warmer weather, this will subside at a greater rate. Well, Arizona can get pretty darn hot. So I'm just being optimistic, Mike. I'm hoping that if that is the case, this could be something that could move forward. And you know, it gets hot out there, even sometimes in spring training. So maybe that could help with the whole situation of this proposal.
Yeah, the warm weather, I mean, it's not warm, it's just plain hot. And, I mean, you can get some days in Arizona or in Phoenix where it's up to 116 degrees. And they can talk about it's a dry heat all they want, but it's just plain hot. So that's, you know, that's one of the things that they've, you know, been concerns about as well. And when do you play the games? I think the big thing that they would like to do, and I'm not even sure Major League Baseball has really floated this plan. I think Scott Boras is the one that's kind of been the, you know, the mastermind behind it all, and he's kind of thrown it out there, because Major League Baseball, I don't think they've done anything. I mean, I'm sure it's been discussed. But I think the ideal thing would be to get real live sporting events and baseball back on the air. I know Major League Baseball is trying to do a concerted effort to get the millennial type crowds back into enjoying or watching baseball and get them to buy into it. And what better way to do it besides have all your hometown teams, and that's the only live sporting event on TV at the time, to get them back into it. So the heat, though, when do you play these games? If you ideally wanted to play, for example, in the Eastern time zone for your fans to be able to watch a game at 7 p.m. Eastern time, it's going to be 4 o'clock out there. So you're going to have to deal with not only the heat, but you're probably going to have to deal with the shadows, with the sun. And it can be a circus out there sometimes with the sun and the high skies that you have out there. So do you play night games? Well, and I've been out there when I was with the Arizona Diamondbacks and in Tucson. And really, by the time you get to a night game at 7 o'clock, it cools off, and it's really, I should say, it doesn't cool off, but at least it's comfortable and you can play. So I think if they're going to do any time frame of when they're going to play, you're probably going to have to be playing at least 7 o'clock at night or sometime fairly early in the morning.
Boy, it really does seem, you know, one, it sounds great on paper, but also could you imagine the chaos if there were, let's just say, a rainy week? When you think about how many games they'd be trying to stack one on top of the other to get as many games in as possible, if indeed they were to move forward with this, what do you think two or three rainy days in a row, if that were to happen, would do to just creating chaos?
It would create chaos. And the big thing about it is, I mean, when are you going to make these games up? And you do have, usually in July and August, you have that monsoon season, where those thunderstorms and rain showers run through there, and it can rain for 3 or 4 days and just almost make really the fields unplayable for a couple days. So you could run through a week where you can't play games, and I don't know when you're going to make them up. And like we talked about before, playing the seven-inning doubleheaders, I think, like I said, I'm not a big fan of that in the long run when we get back to playing baseball. But I think for this year, it may be the only thing that we can do, and it doesn't tax your pitching quite as bad. But the other thing is you're going to have expanded rosters, which kind of part of what I do is the advanced scouting end of it. So now instead of preparing not for 25 or 26 now, which it was supposed to be, now you're probably going to have to prepare for a 35-man roster for every series. So there's a lot of questions and things. It's tantalizing. It sounds like a fun idea, and it'd be great to get back to baseball, but there's a lot of things that will have to be worked out before this comes to fruition.
Well, and as major league camps were fired up, they hadn't quite gotten all the way to the point where players were assigned to their respective minor league organizations, whether it be high A, low A, go through an double A, triple A. What do you think might be any kind of program for the minor leaguers? Because there's nowhere where you could gather all of them to where they get to play. And as you mentioned, you would have expanded rosters. You would likely, of course, have to replace any injured players. What do you think could possibly be a plan that would keep minor leaguers ready for a call that could come just a week into this?
Yeah, I don't – that's a good question. And I know that, you know, for our Zoom calls, a lot of people have asked that question. Are the minor leagues going to play this year? What's going on with that? I don't think Major League Baseball has a plan for it. I think they want to get the major league side of it back on the field and then deal with that. It was going to be really kind of tough starting the regular season this year on March 26th because the minor league season wasn't going to start until April 9th. So really, when they finally brought all this and said, okay, we're sending everybody home, I think the minor leaguers had only played one game. And so they've got a long way to go to ramp up and get ready anyway. And I don't know how they're going to be able to play a whole group of minor league games where you're going to have rookie ball all the way through AAA.
Mike, I got one question for you. Where were you 46 years ago when Hank Aaron hit home run 715?
I'm trying to think where I was. I think I was at home watching it on TV in Columbus, Ohio, to be honest with you. And I do remember that. That was, boy, what a thing. I mean, to think about him breaking Babe Ruth's record at the time was just was amazing. It was a magical moment, that's for sure.
Mike, we sure do appreciate it. Always look forward to your insight and how you break down what's going on with Major League Baseball, and really hope that, we can just get closer to good news for everybody involved. But I just wanted to see what your thoughts were on this proposed plan that could have everybody gathering in Arizona to see if they can't get the season underway. But I don't think there's any question people would eat it up with spoons if they had the opportunity to see a competitive sport back on the field, team against team, don't you think?
I couldn't agree more. And, the players thrive on the fans being in the stands, but I'll tell you, the biggest thing that they do, especially those guys at the Major League level, they thrive on competition. And I think it would be fantastic, but, we're just going to have to see. And like I said, if I hear more about it and we're getting closer to it, I'll let you guys know for sure.
We sure do appreciate it, Mike. Take care of yourself, stay well, be safe, and we look forward to catching up with you again soon.
You as well, John and Jimmy. Good talking to you as always.
Thanks, Mike.
Good talking to you. That's Mike Barnett joining us on the Stanley Fanson Gates Hotline. We'll get a break and be back with a final segment to hour number three of Sports Talk on 99.1 The Sports Animal.
From the Budweiser studios of Cumulus Broadcasting.
Guys, I'm bringing the party to you.
This is Sports Radio WNML.
And we're still bringing the party to you up till about 7 o'clock as you listen to Sports Talk. With Jimmy Himes, I'm John Wilkerson. We look forward to being joined by Ryan McGee, senior writer for ESPN, as he will join us around 6:15. And, Jimmy, you were talking with Mike Barnett about it. So hard to believe it is the 46th anniversary of home run number 715, but one of the iconic moments in sports history, and one of those that actually I think exceeded the landscape of sports. It was national history when you consider that Babe Ruth's 714 home runs was thought to be unbreakable, just as Hank Aaron's 755, what he finished was thought to be uncatchable.
Yeah, when I first became a baseball fan, there was a magic number. It was 714, and it seemed like everybody that followed baseball knew what that number meant. They knew the significance of it. And the thing about Babe Ruth was that around the time that he started to crank out home runs, there was a guy named, Frank Home Run Baker, hit like 12 in a season, and that led the league.
Yeah.
So if you could hit 10 or 12, you were a mighty power hitter. Well, then Babe Ruth comes along, and next thing you know, he's hitting 30, 40, 58, whatever, 60. And, he was so far ahead of everybody else in terms of home runs that he was hitting. And then I guess the next closest guy to him for a while was his teammate Lou Gehrig. But, yeah, that was a magical number. It was for so many years. And to see Hank Aaron do it, I remember exactly where I was, exactly what I was doing when I saw that. And I think a lot of other people remember that well because it was such a monumental moment.
Oh, it was. And I could tell you exactly the gigantic console television that I was watching it on down in our family room. But just remember that. That was such a magic moment. Baseball the year before was when I had really struck a chord with me and started collecting baseball cards and was really such a big fan, not only of Hank Aaron, but also just the Braves. And went to my first game in 1974. That was after he had set the new record, but that was such a big year. And that's why, to me, that 74 Braves look is still the greatest, bar none, of any team in any uniform. I know some people, in retrospect, have said, oh, they look like softball unis. Oh, no. They are the standard for all baseball uniforms, especially with that feather on each sleeve. That was just classic in my mind.
Well, and that was a pretty darn good Atlanta team, too. They had some pretty fair players that were playing with Hank Aaron at that time.
Very much so. And as we were talking about a possible return for baseball with Major League Baseball with Mike Barnett, something to see in terms of a lot of attention is being focused on South Korea,
yeah,
for them being further down the road and battling COVID-19 as the United States is still trying to get on top of it. But baseball could restart in South Korea as early as next month, and there are some that are thinking you could see the first exhibition games April 21st.
Yeah.
So it's so hard to believe that if everything goes perfectly, you could see on-field action in less than 2 weeks in South Korea. But that one I think I'll believe when I see. What do you think?
Well, I'm kind of in your camp, but I hope they're right. I hope they can start the preseason games April 21st. I hope that they can start the regular season in early May. I think it would be a good sign for a lot of people, and I guess a lot of people are kind of like me and probably you. We're looking for any positive sign out there to get sports back on the table. And in Korea, I don't know if they can do that or not, but I think that would be something that would give you some hope that that they have turned the corner there, and maybe that we can get the corner turned in the United States here in the next few weeks.
And when you're talking about positive, when you're talking about hope, we want to throw a quick shout-out to our first hero of health from the submissions at our website, 99.1thesportsanimal.com. And we say congratulations to Dusty Barnett. He is an advanced EMT at Morgan County Ambulance Service. He's also a paramedic student at Roane State Community College. And so he is he cares about his patients, provides excellent patient care, and Dusty and his wife have 8 children. So we say congratulations to Dusty Barnett, as well as everyone like him that's out there doing their very best to make sure everyone gets taken care of. And the spotlight on our hero of health is brought to you by Roane State Community College. Visit roanestate.edu, where we're all succeeding online together. We'll get a break. When we return, it's Golden Attaboy that hangs in the balance. Showcase your mad trivia skills with the Sports Fix at 6. That's next as we start hour number 4 of Sports Talk on 99.1 The Sports Animal.